time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a 27-year veteran with the CIA, serving as an analyst from 1963 to 1990. He was Robert Gates' branch chief in the early 1970s. From 1981 to 1985, he was an intelligence briefer for President Reagan, where he was in charge of preparing daily security briefs for the president, vice president, joint chiefs of staff, national security advisor, and the cabinet. He also was one of several CIA analysts who prepared the president's daily brief during the first Bush administration. He is co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of Tell the World, an expression of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, D.C. Ray, thank you very much for coming and spending time with
us this morning. You're most welcome, Mike.
Let's begin with you are just a little over a week back from being in Moscow and awarding Edward Snowden. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's the Sam Adams Award for Integrity and Intelligence, and various people have been commenting to me, wow, we didn't know that the Sam Adams Brewery sponsored these awards. No, it's not that Sam Adams, as much as I like Sam Adams beer. No, it's a colleague of mine who entered the CIA at exactly the same time I did under John Kennedy when he was president. Early 1963. Sam was out of Harvard. He had served in the Navy in Vietnam. He was back and went to Harvard Law School for a year and said, this is not for me. Heard, as I did, about this incredible opportunity at this new agency, the CIA, where analysts would be given an inbox, in those days a wooden inbox, full of material from spies, from overhead photography, from intercepted messages, from State Department, FBI. It all came together here, and we were responsible. We were accountable, a word that's disappeared from the vocabulary and work, for looking at that, making some sense out of it, and telling the president what it meant without fear or favor. Okay, that's what Truman envisaged the CIA. Long story short, Sam was so bright that he was given the account of counting up how many communists were under arms in South Vietnam. We're talking 64, 65, 66. Would you believe that nobody had done that yet? Would you believe that we were basing our estimates on enemy strength on U.S. Army material from the 50s and early 60s? So Sam went at it with all this. He was an incredible guy. He took a table full of information, put it all together, found out that there were either 500,000 or 600,000 communists under arms in South Vietnam. And then he looked at what General Westmoreland was saying. No, there could only be 299,000. Does that figure give you a little pause there? It's sort of like exactly 1,429 people, victims of chemical attack. You know, the precision itself gives it away. You buy something for $59.95, here's 299,000. So Sam went out to Saigon to have it out. And he said, okay, well, this regiment we both have on our books, it has 300 people. I said, no, I only have 150 people. He says, wait a second, all those regiments have... So it went like that. In the bar at night, one of the sergeants came in, Mr. Adams, you might as well go home, because General Westmoreland is not going to let any more than 299,000, because, the press in Saigon is not real bright, but, they do arithmetic, and we've been killing so many people every week, that we can possibly admit the real figures now. Then, on August 20th, 1967, came in a cable. Now, Westmoreland was out of Saigon, but General Abrams, the guy from after whom they named the tank, okay, and he sent this cable. I want to read it to you. He's talking about how it's not possible to accept the higher numbers because they, quote, were in sharp contrast to the current overall strength figure of 299,000 given to the press. Quote, we have been projecting an image of success over recent months, and he cautioned, quote, all available caveats and explanations will not prevent the press from drawing an erroneous and gloomy conclusion, end quote. Give me a break. So Sam told me about this over lunch, August 20, 1967. Neither he nor I confess, had the guts to do what Bradley Manning did, what Ed Snowden did. We should have gone down to the Washington Bureau of the New York Times that very day and brought a copy of the thing, if we could squirrel out a copy, and said, look, you know, this is what's going on here. August 1967. Now, younger people should realize that the New York Times in those days, it was an independent newspaper. And, you know, when you gave them something like that, they wouldn't go to the White House and say, hey, we got this. Do you think we could publish? No, they'd publish it. And Dan Ellsberg learned that and others, okay? So both of us lived with a lot of regret, a lot of remorse that we'd have the guts to go out of the system and tell the American people what was going on. Sam died an early death with great remorse, great regret. It was a sudden heart attack, completely unexpected. And what he really regretted was that left wing of the Vietnam Memorial. You know, those years, it wouldn't be there today because there'd be no names to chisel into that granite, okay? That's big. That's a lot to carry. And I carry that too, okay? So when I see people facing up to this kind of situation and doing what Ellsberg has always suggested, don't just blabber out, come out with the documents. Well, Chelsea Manning did that to a fairly well, didn't he? And now Ed Snowden, much more judiciously, but with the real creme de la creme, is showing how our Fourth Amendment has just been trashed. And we knew the Fifth Amendment was trashed because the president says he could kill Americans, okay? Without due process. Well, with the due process that we do in the White House, you know, no judicial process. We know about the First Amendment, but here's the Fourth Amendment. I want to read you. I found this useful when giving interviews because it's one sentence. And when you look at it, well, I'll just read it for you. You can see. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. Okay? Supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Well, hello, you know, probable cause. Well, does that mean that all of us who use telephones or email that we're, you know, there's probable cause to believe that we're terrorists, you know? I remember when we didn't have the technology, but a lot of us, a lot of my forebears were considered to be maybe communists, you know? So it's that same sort of very repressive atmosphere. And this time, the technology allows us to collect everything. And guess what? It's easier to collect everything than to target things. So talk about particulars of the people, or no particulars, probable cause, give me a break, none of that. So the right of us people here under the Fourth Amendment has been trashed. And Ed Snowden, to his great credit, you know, saw that and said, you know, this is really nice in Honolulu, $100,000 salary, nice girlfriend, you know, beach. But do I really want to be part of this? You know, do I really want to be part of this? And faithful to his oath, which we all took, you know, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, he figured out a way not to try to go through channels, as Sam Adams did and got diddled, okay, not to do what Chelsea Manning did and be liable to being that kind of being subjected to torture by the Marine Corps of all people, and not to do what Thomas Drake did. For 4 years he was persecuted. Not prosecuted, persecuted, okay? The last year, before the trial was supposed to begin, it was incredibly severe, the pressure they put him under, and he faced up to it. He said, I'm not going to confess to something I didn't do. And finally, when the judge ruled that there was no material here to put forward a case, it said, you Justice Department lawyers, you should be ashamed of yourselves. You should be ashamed of yourselves. Don't ever bring a case like this with no evidence to support it to me again, okay? Well, now he's vindicated, but he's been through torture for 4 years. Now, is there any good come out of that? I don't think Tom Drake ever thought there were. But when I saw him come into Moscow and see Ed Snowden, when I saw Ed Snowden see Tom Drake, now, Ed, you know, I just perceived, and Ed says, my God, this is the guy responsible for me being free. This is the guy whose experience I drew from in saying, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to be successful, get all these abusers out, I can't do it through the system. I can't do it here in the United States. I got to get out of Dodge, okay? And I got to figure a clever way to get correspondents to meet me in Hong Kong. So he's looking at Tom Drake like this, and Tom Drake is looking, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm putting these thoughts in his mind, but he must have been thinking, God, you know, I never thought any good would come out of these 4 years, you know? But here's some good, you know? Here's Ed. He's safe. He's protected. Ironically, he's in the safest country of the world. There aren't any good SEAL 6 teams. They're not going to go into Russia. And despite what the head of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, and General Mike Hayden have suggested two weeks ago, Hayden says, you know, this list for an award that Snowden's on, I got another list that I got to put Snowden on. I got him a favorite list that I like to put him on. And, of course, he's talking about the kill list for assassination, okay, that the president reviews every Tuesday morning before he has a nice lunch with Michelle, decides who's going to live and who's going to die. And Mike Rogers, who's there at this public meeting, says, well, yeah, I can help you out on that. This is the head of the House Intelligence Committee. So they're openly suggesting that Ed Snowden be zapped, okay? And that's the height of the irony here, because he's in a place, not of his own choosing, by accident, largely for two reasons. The fact that there is an international law that says when one seeks asylum in a place, having been deprived of his own passport, that countries are legally bound to honor that. And the other thing, of course, is he never expected to be in Moscow. He was ticketed through, but when the U.S. did what it did, and when John Kerry got up and said, I know there's no extradition treaty between Russia and the United States, but you must give Ed Snowden up because, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, Vladimir Putin doesn't take kindly to that kind of talk. I think he got his back up. Besides, he's adopted the high moral ground here. He's giving refuge to a person who has no country now, or who at least has no passport. And, you know, the role reversal here. I spent time in Moscow in the 70s, and, you know, the bad guys used to be the KGB. Well, we feared, that is, Colleen Rowley, Jessalyn Radak, and Tom Drake, my three colleagues, whistleblowers, what we feared was not the KGB or its successor in Moscow. What we feared is getting back in our country, our own country, because you know what's happened to people, their laptops and all. We didn't bring any laptops. We had one little primitive cell phone. That's how we communicated with everyone in Moscow, by design, because we didn't want to be subjected to unreasonable searches and seizures of our laptops, of our cell phones, and all that kind of stuff. In the event, we got through JFK Kennedy Airport without incident. But I think part of that was the fact that the publicity attached to our award had actually been impossible for even some of the mass media to avoid.
So what did you think of Edward Snowden? Did you get to talk with him personally for a while?
Yeah, we did. We had the ceremony. It was sort of shepherded by Anatoly Kucherina, who was a civil rights lawyer. He kind of presided over the beginning, gave us gifts and so forth, and he said, now I can only stay 5 minutes, so you could have the ceremony. Well, an hour and a half later, Kucherina is still there. It was an incredible ceremony. You probably saw the pictures of Tom Drake giving the Emmy, you know, the Oscar equivalent. It's a corner brightener candlestick holder for those who shine light in the darkest kinds of corners, okay? Now, it's been given to some pretty interesting people in the past. Colleen Rowley was the first. She, of course, was Person of the Year in 2002, because of what she revealed regarding FBI mistakes, or worse, before 9/11. Since then, we've had people like Larry Wilkerson, who was awarded 09, I believe. Yeah, it was 09, because of what he did in kind of saying, well, you know, I was part of this as Colin Powell's chief of staff, that preparation of that not mistaken, but fraudulent estimate is something I'll regret for the rest of my life. And Larry's spoken out. Julian Assange was our awardee the next year, 2010, and Jan Ellsberg and Craig Murray, ambassador to Uzbekistan for the UK, handled giving to Julian Assange the corner brightener candlestick holder at the end of that big press conference when Julian Assange revealed what he had. And since then, it's been equally interesting. Jesselyn Radick and Tom Drake won it together, ex equo, 2 years ago. And last year, we made the presentation in the Oxford Forum, the big debating thing. We lucked into having Tom Finger, Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence, who, his distinction, he's not a whistleblower. He simply acted in an ethical, honest way in the best tradition of intelligence analysis. He ran the estimate on Iran in 2007, took the whole year, threw out all the other stuff, built it up from the bottom, and 16 intelligence agencies came to the conclusion with high confidence that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003. My arithmetic is pretty good. That's 10 years ago. And has not resumed work on a nuclear weapon, okay? That played a huge role in stopping the war that Bush and Cheney prepared for 2008, their last year in office. Now, don't take my word for that. Read Bush's memoir. Now, don't buy it. No, I don't suggest you buy Decision Points, Bush's memoir. But look around 474 page or something like that. He must have written it himself. He says, when that estimate came out, I was shocked. It was eye-popping. I asked myself, why would they say this? I guess it didn't occur to him that they would say it because it was true. You know, he says, this deprived me of the military option. And then there's a great quote, you know, one sentence. He says, for how could I possibly justify launching an attack on a country that our intelligence community says, with high confidence, has no active nuclear weapons development program, end quote. Bummer, you know? Bummer! he says that right in the thing. So what we did was award Tom Finger this award, not because he was a whistleblower, because he rendered it not necessary for whistleblowers to come forth and say, look, they're skewing this next estimate on Iran, and played, again, a huge role in preventing the war that they had planned. So that was Finger last time, and now when Ed Snowden did what he did, you know, we have a very broad spectrum of people in our Sam Adams Associates. Some of them are, you know, retired military, almost generals. We have no generals, I guess, for obvious reasons. But, you know, there was a lot of reluctance. Is this guy the real deal? You know, why did he go to Hong Kong? Oh, why did he end up in Russia? Well, all these things very gradually became completely clear, okay? And so we had a vote, and it wasn't unanimous this time, but it was a clear majority, and so we decided to give him the award. And we're just delighted that we did, because the next step was, how do we get it to him? You know, our tradition is you present it personally. So this is worth mentioning, too. We were asked to speak at what used to be called Hacker Conference. It was outside of Amsterdam. And I was asked to do the keynote because they wanted to broaden the perspective, you know, what's going on. I looked out at these 3,000 high-tech guys, and I said, my God, there's a lot of hope, because the NSA and others can't do what they want to do without the help of these highly technical people, okay? And even if only 5% of them have a conscience, and only 3% of those, you know, will speak out like Ed Snowden has, man, this is going to work out. Now, when we told them, we had what they called a spy panel, and it was Tom Drake, Jesselyn Radick, Colleen Rowley, myself, and a British whistleblower by the name of Annie Machon, you know, who blew the whistle on MI5, the counterpart of the FBI, what they were doing. So we're talking about the Snowden Prize and how we just awarded it, and then we said, you know, our challenge is to get to Moscow to award it. And it looked like, you know, a formidable challenge, partly because of the cost. You know what they did? They took up a collection. They crowdsourced it, okay? And we had enough money, boom, like that, for the plane fare, for the four of us, for a hotel of the caliber I very seldom stay in. And they worked through WikiLeaks. And again, Sarah Harrison from WikiLeaks has been with Snowden every day since she help them get out of Hong Kong. Why? Well, so that she can be a witness that the KGB successor is not, you know, is not using enhanced interrogation techniques, you know, on Snowden. So WikiLeaks did it. They crowdsourced sources from the hacker community, and the Russian civil rights lawyer, Anatoly Kucherina, just facilitated. He was wonderful. And it was just, it worked out in a way that it was scarcely believable by us, even though we dearly hoped that we could do that in person.
And how did Edward Snowden receive the award? I mean,
well, he was just happy to see us. It was clear, and we were happy to see him, of course. And after he I read the citation, of course, and as I usually do, and Ed Drake, Tom Drake, gave the Oscar, so to speak, the corner brightener candlestick holder. And actually, we had we had two candlestick holders. One was the traditional one that we give, but one was a 3D thing made out of a kind of Xerox machine thing, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the one you see in the photo. So it was given to him, and I whispered in his ear. I said, Ed, you know, it would be appropriate now if you'd like to say a few words, you know. And he said, okay. He sat down, and if you see it, Amy Goodman ran 3 minutes of it. I mean, it's like that guy had a prepared speech that he memorized. Fluent, funny, completely informed of what's going on. It was really quite amazing. And you can see it for yourself. So here's a guy who keeps in touch, was really happy to hear from our lawyers, Jessica Laredick and Colleen Rowley, because they're in touch with what's really going on in Congress. Colleen Rowley, having sat through that session where the late, almost departed General Alexander, who has now said he's going to leave, where he was asked about these 54 terrorist events that NSA's programs had thwarted, you know? And to his credit, Pat Leahy, the head of the judiciary, says, well, how many of those had to do with America? We think 13. Oh, and how many of those were actually plots that you could show us were thwarted? One. Well, what was that? Well, that was some group of Somalis out in California throwing a couple of $1,000s at the bad guys in Somalia, I guess. And Clapper, the head of all intelligence, was there, and he said, well, perhaps two. So, you know, when he claimed 54 and turns out to one, and you can bet that FBI is scurrying around trying to find others, you know, and Clapper says perhaps two, as if to make that better. Clapper is a self-confessed perjurer. He's the one that said NSA doesn't collect any information on Americans, much less millions or hundreds of millions of Americans, after Ron Wyden asked him that question. After Ron Wyden told him he was going to ask that question, what does Clapper do? He said, no, sir. No, sir. Not wittingly, you know. He says, since apologized for that thing. I said things that were clearly erroneous, end quote. And he said, I apologize. But he's still there. He's still running the intelligence. So, you know, how's that figure? What's with this Obama guy, you know? Well, at least Alexander's leaving now in disgrace, but not for several months, if you believe the press. What about Clapper? Why does he stay in there? Well, the answer to that is pretty complicated. I don't know if Obama's afraid of these guys, which is a possibility, or whether they haven't been upfront with him. In other words, there's something called plausible denial. Why would Obama get up and repeat lies if he knew they were lies? Well, it seems equally possible to me that they haven't shared the whole, you know, the whole nine yards with him. And so what does he say? Well, they never told me what, you know. No, he's in a real bind. So he keeps Clapper on, and the whole world sees you get a liar, a self-confessed liar. I mean, we don't say liar in Washington. We say a prevaricator or somebody who plays fast and loose with the truth, you know. But he's a liar. And so he stays in office. I would think that if Obama had any guts at all, that he would get rid of Clapper and start afresh. But apparently he's afraid. Apparently he figures that's going too far. And that speaks volumes.
About 4 minutes left. You did an interview earlier this year where you were talking about Obama at a dinner party saying he mentioned that Don't you remember what happened to MLK?
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, that was quite revealing. This is from a very good source, although it's secondhand. It wasn't he, but a friend of his who was at this dinner party. High rollers, you know, big fundraiser people. And they were giving him a hard time, Obama, about, what happened to your progressive tendencies, you know? Good question. And finally, he got kind of irate, and he said, well, don't you guys remember what happened to MLK? Now, we know that our government did in Martin Luther King Jr. That's proven. I believe that the best book on the assassination of John Kennedy is JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas, and that persuades me, plus what other stuff I know, that our government and Alan Dulles, who John Kennedy fired from the CIA, and the others saw that he was not somebody that should hang around as president. He was being soft on communism. He was withdrawing troops from Vietnam, the whole nine yards. So when we talk about assassination as being an American tradition, it is. And we didn't even mention Robert Kennedy. And so it makes sort of sense for any person like Obama to be mindful of that. But, you know, if he was going to let it deter his integrity or his freedom of action, yeah, I think he ought to have said, no, I won't run for president because I'm too scared, okay? But he is president. And I've checked with the doctors at the George Washington University Hospital, see how far along they are with a backbone implant, you know? It's going to be 3 more years, they tell me. So it's up to us, you know. There never has been any other. It's up to us. The good news is that we, all of us, were able to stop the next war against Syria. That was us. That was the British citizens. Parliament voted against the Prime Minister wanting to do a war for the first time in history, okay? And we were about to have our representatives and senators, because they were home when all this happened, you know. Oh, we're going to have another war. Well, you're not going to have another war, you know. Over my dead body, you're going to have another war. So that plus a whole bunch of other things, as I reconstructed, the Joint Chiefs of Staff went to Obama after Kerry said, you know, we're going to zap these guys. After they warned the Israelis, put up your defenses because the attack is coming in 24 hours. The military got to Obama in the form of Dempsey. And when Obama got up and reversed his decision, what he said was, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has advised me that we're prepared to do this today, but we don't have to. We do it tomorrow. We can do it next week, next month. There is no time sensitivity for our doing this. And so as I reconstructed, Dempsey went and said, you know, I know you like those young fellas and those young tough gals that you got there now, but they don't know diddly about war. We know about war, okay? And we know it's not possible to have an unbelievably small war, okay, as John Kerry said. And we also know, and I know, that when the press comes to me and says, why do you have to do this now, and you couldn't wait for the UN inspector report, I'm going to have to say, beats the hell out of me. Go ask the president. Now, there's lots of evidence that's the way it went down. And it's the first time, yeah, it's the most remarkable sequence of events that I've observed in 50 years in Washington. But it worked. Obama didn't want to do it in the first place, but it was the military and it was us. And that's the good news. It was us. We can do these things. We have to really get with our representatives and congressmen, senators, and make sure they know how we feel. And about this, we feel pretty strongly, don't we?
Mm. Hopefully enough of us still have backbone.
Yeah.
We're talking with Ray McGovern. He is a 27-year veteran of the CIA and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And you have a website, don't you?
Yes, it's raymcgovern.com.
All right.
My youngest son runs it, and he posts things pretty quickly.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're most welcome.